44. Out in the Open. To the Mukadligan family, Nara and her Innocenti had been far-off, disembodied relatives until a year ago. They had flitted through Moscow for one short week in a year and sent presents at holiday times. Clara, who had got used to calling Galachov her famous older brother-in-law, Kolya, was still shy and tongue-tied with Innocenti. But last summer they had stayed longer, and Nara was often at her parents' apartment, usually complaining about her husband and the shadow over their marriage, which until recently had been so happy. She and Alevtina Nikaronovna discussed it at length, and if she happened to be at home, Clara listened, openly or surreptitiously. She could not have refrained even if she had wanted to. This was, after all, life's greatest mystery. What made people love each other or not love each other? Her sister told them about all sorts of trivial incidents, disagreements, quarrels, suspicions, and also about Innocenti's professional misjudgments. He had changed so much. He showed no respect for the opinions of important people, and this affected their material position, so that Nara had to go without things. As she told it, Nara was always right, her husband always wrong. Clara, privately, drew quite different conclusions. Nara did not know how lucky she was. She probably no longer loved Innocenti, but only herself. What she cared about was not his work, but the status it gave her. Not his views and preferences, however they might have changed, but her possession of him, asserted for all to see. Clara was surprised to find that her sister resented her husband's suspected infidelities less than his failure to emphasize sufficiently in the presence of other women that she alone was supremely important to him. The unmarried younger sister could not help comparing her own situation with Nara's, and telling herself that, come what may, she would have behaved differently. How could Nara be satisfied with anything that left him unhappy? Their problem was aggravated by their childlessness. Once Clara had opened her heart on the stairway, they were on such easy terms that she urgently needed to see more of him. She had such a backlog of questions that Innocenti was just the man to answer. But the presence of Nara, or any other member of the family, would somehow make it awkward. So when Innocenti suggested, shortly afterward, a day out in the country, her heart missed a beat, and she agreed without thinking. No manor houses, museums, or famous ruins, though, Innocenti said with a faint smile. I don't like them either, was Clara's firm response. Now that she knew some of his troubles, his half-hearted smile caused a twinge of sympathy. Switzerland and places like that can drive a man crazy, he said. Wandering around ordinary Russian countryside is good enough for me. Think we can find any? Clara nodded vigorously. We can if we try. It was left unclear whether this was to be an outing for two or for three. But Innocenti arranged to meet her on a weekday at the Kiev station. He did not phone his home and would not call for Clara at Kaluga Gate, which made it obvious that there would be just the two of them, and that Clara's parents were probably not supposed to know. As far as her sister was concerned, Clara felt quite entitled to this outing. Even if his marriage had been perfect, Innocenti would have been just paying his family dues. As things were, Nara had only herself to blame. Would there ever again be such a wonderful day in Clara's life? There would certainly be none for which preparations were so agonizing. What should she wear? If her women friends could be believed, no color suited her, but she had to choose one of them. She put on a brown dress and carried a blue coat. Her veil gave her more trouble than anything. The night before, she spent 2 hours trying it on, taking it off, trying it on again. Some lucky people can make their minds up at once. Clara was crazy about veils. Especially in films, they made a woman enigmatic, raised her beyond the reach of critical scrutiny. Still, she decided against it. Innocenti had grown tired of French frippery, and besides, it was going to be a sunny day. She did put on her black net gloves, though. Black net gloves were very pretty. The Maloyaroslav train was waiting when they arrived. A small steam locomotive, it was splendid. They had no particular station in mind. They simply took tickets to the end of the line. The route was so new to them that they were both startled when fellow passengers mentioned a station called Nara. If Innocenti had known about it, he might perhaps have chosen a different terminus. If Clara had ever known, she had completely forgotten. "Nara, Nara, Nara!" They heard the name over and over again in the course of the journey. It seemed to haunt them. It was a cool morning for August. They were both cheerful and animated, and they were soon chatting freely about anything and everything. Occasional lapses into formality ended in laughter, and made them feel even more at ease. Innocenti was wearing some sort of Western sports outfit, unconcernedly creasing and rumpling what he evidently thought of as casual clothes. They had the whole day ahead of them, but Clara began eagerly interrogating him, switching erratically from questions about Europe to problematic aspects of Soviet life. She wasn't quite sure herself what she wanted to know, but she knew there was something. She longed to be cleverer. She had to get to the bottom of it. Innocenti wagged his head comically. "Do you really think, little Clara, that I understand any of it myself? But you diplomats are there to show the rest of us the way, and now you tell me you don't understand." "Ah, but all my colleagues do understand. It's only I who don't. And even I understood it all till sometime last year or the year before last."
"Then what happened?"
"Do you know, that's another thing I don't understand," Innocenti said laughingly. "And anyway, my little Clara, who knows where the explanation should start? It goes back to the very beginning of things. Suppose a caveman suddenly popped out from under the seat here and asked us to explain in not more than 5 minutes how trains can run on electricity. What would we tell him? First of all, off you go and learn to read. Then get on with your arithmetic, algebra, draftsmanship, electrotechnology. Have I forgotten anything?"
"I don't know. Magnetics, perhaps?"
"There you are. You don't know either. And you're in your final year. Then I would say, come back in 15 years' time, and I'll explain it in 5 minutes, only by then you'll know it all yourself."
"Very well. I'm willing to learn. But how do I go about it? Where do I begin?"
"Well, our newspapers will do for a start." A man with a leather satchel was passing through the train selling newspapers. Innocenti bought Pravda from him. Clara had realized when they boarded the train that they would be having a rather special conversation, and she had sent Innocenti ahead to occupy an uncomfortable double seat by a door. Innocenti hadn't understood, but only there could they talk more or less freely. "All right, now for our reading lesson," he said, unfolding the paper. "Take this headline: Women filled with labor enthusiasm overfulfill norms. Ask yourself why they have to think about norms at all. Don't they have anything to do at home? What it means is that the combined wages of husband and wife aren't enough to support a family, whereas the husband's wage alone ought to be enough.
Is it enough in France?
And everywhere else? Look, here's another bit. In all the capitalist countries together, there are fewer day nurseries than in our country.
True? Probably.
But one little detail is left out. In all other countries, women are freer to bring up their children themselves, so they don't need all these nurseries." The train shuddered. They were moving. Innocenti found another text without difficulty, pointed to it, and spoke into her ear through the racket. "Now, take any apparently insignificant form of words. Member of the French Parliament so-and-so made a statement about the hatred of the French people for the Americans."
"Did he?" you ask.
"He probably did. We only print the truth. But something is left out. What party does he belong to? If he were not a communist, they would certainly say so, because it would make his utterance all the more valuable. So he is a communist. But they don't say so. And that's the way it always is, Clairette. They'll write about record snowfall somewhere, with thousands of cars buried in drifts, a national disaster. But the artful implication is that where there are so many cars, it isn't worth building garages for them. These are all examples of freedom from information. The same sort of thing turns up in the sports pages. Match ended in well-deserved victory. No need to read on. Obviously our side won. But if, to the surprise of the spectators, the jury declared so-and-so the winner, so-and-so is obviously not one of ours." Innocenti looked around for somewhere to throw away the newspaper. obviously not realizing that this was another example of un-Soviet behavior. People had already begun looking around at them. Clara took the newspaper from him and held on to it. "Anyway, sport is the opiate of the people," Innocenti concluded. That surprised and offended her, and coming from such a slight person, it didn't ring at all true. Clara shook her head indignantly. "I play tennis a lot, and I really love it." Innocenti hurriedly corrected himself. "Playing games is fine. What is terrible is the passion for spectator sports. Sports for the mass spectator, football and hockey, make idiots of us." The train rattled along. They looked through the window.
"So life is good there?"
Clara asked.
"Better than here?"
Innocenti nodded.
"Better, but still not good. There's a difference. What is lacking there?"
Innocenti looked at her gravely. His earlier animation had given way to thoughtful calm.
"It's difficult to say. I find it surprising myself. There's something missing. In fact, there are many things missing."
Clara was, by now, completely at ease with him. She felt in his company an enjoyment that had nothing to do with flirtatious contacts and inflections, there were none, and she wanted to show her gratitude, to make him feel happier and more confident.
"You have such an interesting job," she said soothingly.
"Who, me?" Innocenti sounded surprised. He had always been thin, and now he looked feeble and half-starved.
"To work in our diplomatic service, Clara, my dear, you need a double wall in your chest, two thicknesses of skull, and two separate memories."
He left it at that, sighed, and looked out the window. Did his wife understand any of this? Did she do anything to encourage and comfort him? Clara studied him carefully and noticed for the first time a distinctive feature. By itself, the upper part of his face looked quite hard, while the lower part, seen alone, was soft. From his broad and open forehead, his features narrowed, slanting downward to a mouth so small and sensitive that it made him look helpless. The day was getting hot. Woodlands sped merrily past. The route took them through heavily wooded country. The farther the train went, the fewer city people there were left in the car, and the more conspicuous the two of them became. They looked like actors in costume. Clara took off her gloves. They left the train at a stop in the forest. Peasant women with shopping bags full of groceries from town emerged from the next car. No one else was left behind with them on the platform. The young people had meant to go into the forest. There was forest along both sides of the line, but it was dense, dark, and uninviting. As soon as the train moved its tail out of their way, the women walked over a timbered crossing together and made for a place past the trees to the right. Clara and Innocenti followed them. Immediately beyond the track, grass and flowers grew shoulder-high. Then the path plunged into a plantation of birch saplings. Beyond that was a mowed space with a single haycock and a goat tethered to a stake by a long rope, pensively browsing when it remembered to. The forest now closed in on their left, but the women stepped out briskly to the right into the sunshine and toward the open ground beyond a few more bushes. The young people, too, decided that the forest could wait. Right now they were drawn irresistibly into that brilliant sunlight. The way there was by a firm, grassy field path. Between this and the railway line lay a field of some golden grain, heavy ears on short, sturdy stalks. Whether it was wheat or some other crop they didn't know, but that made it no less beautiful. On the other side of the path, for almost as far as they could see, lay a bare, ploughed field, waterlogged in places, drier elsewhere, with nothing growing on its great expanse. From where the train had stopped, the countryside into which they were now emerging had been invisible. So spacious was it that two eyes could not take it in without a turn of the head. They were shut in now by forest immediately beyond the railway line, and in the distance ahead of them, forest so dense that it looked like a wall with a serrated edge. Without knowing it, without setting out to find it, this was what they had longed for. Faces upturned to the sky, they stumbled slowly on, stopping now and then to gaze around. The railway line was now concealed by the plantation. Ahead of them, The upper half of a dark red brick church with a bell tower came slowly into view from a dip in the ground. The peasant women were disappearing in that direction, and soon, across the whole landscape, there was no one and nothing else to be seen or heard. No human being, no farmstead, no trailer, no abandoned haymaker. Nothing but the warm revelling of wind and sun, and birds lost in the void. In 2 minutes their earnestness and their worries were forgotten.
"Is this Russia, then? Is this the real Russia?"
Innocenti asked happily, squinting into the distance. He stopped and turned toward Clara.
"I'm supposed to represent Russia, you know, but my own representation of Russia is non-existent. I've never just walked around in Russia like this. It's always been airplanes, trains, big cities."
He intertwined his fingers with hers at arm's length, as children or sweethearts do. They wandered on like that, looking everywhere except where they were putting their feet. His free hand swung a hat, hers a handbag.
"Listen, sister," he said. "I'm so glad we came this way instead of going through the forest. If there's one thing missing in my life, it's that. A clear view all around, and a chance to breathe freely."
"I can't believe that you don't see things clearly."
His plaintive tone had touched her. She would have offered him her own eyes if that would help.
"No," he said, swinging her hand. "I used to, but now everything is mixed up."
What did he mean? If it was all such a muddle, it couldn't be just his ideas. It must be his family life. If he had said just a little more, Clara would have found the courage to speak out, show him that she was on his side, that he was right, and that he must not despair.
"It might help to talk about it," she said tentatively.
But that was all. He had said all he meant to say. It was getting hot. They took off their raincoats. As far as the eye could see, there was now no one coming toward them and no one following them. Occasionally a long train rolled slowly by beyond the screen of trees, almost noiselessly. Only the smoke caught their attention. The peasant women had long ago outdistanced them and turned off the main path. Now they were in the middle of the open field, blurred figures in the bright sunlight. Innocenti and Clara reached the point at which they had turned. A well-trodden path ran over the soft field, losing itself at times in tractor ruts. A path worn by little people tramping obliquely across the planners' great rectangular fields on their humdrum errands. The path led toward the village around the church, but on the way it skirted a remarkable, closely planted clump of trees, isolated out in the field, remote from the forest, and almost as far from the village. A strange, cheerful, flourishing copse of tall, straight trees. Small as it was, it dominated and beautified the landscape. Why was it there, out in the open field? They made their way toward it. Their hands parted. The path was wide enough only for one. Now Innocenti was walking behind Clara.
"He is walking behind you, looking at your back, looking you over. Your sister's husband.
Your brother, then? Or..."
To talk to him, Clara had to stop and turn around.
"What are you going to call me? Just don't call me Clairette."
"All right, I won't. That was before I knew you. In the West they like short pet names, just one or two syllables."
"So maybe I'll call you Ink?"
"Go ahead. That'll do nicely."
"Does anybody else call you that?"
The field was not as flat as they had thought. Ahead and to the left, there was a gentle downward slope. Then the ground rose again to the clump of trees. They could see now that these were mature birches. Rows of trees formed a rectangle, and others had been planted in the space inside it. There was something very surprising about this copse, so isolated and so detached from the landscape.
"When did it all start?"
Clara asked.
"It?"
That one little word could cover a number of things. But he answered readily enough.
"Probably when I started going through my mother's cabinets. Or maybe even earlier, maybe a whole year earlier. But when I started going through the cabinets..."
"After she died?"
"A long time after. A very long time after. Not so long ago, in fact. You see, I..." "No, it's impossible to explain." Dotty won't listen or doesn't understand.
I would understand. Tell me all about Dotty. This is going to be a heart-to-heart talk. You'll feel so much better for it.
You see, young Clara, I was a very bad son. In her lifetime, I never loved my mother as I should. I didn't come home from Syria all through the war, not even to her funeral. Hey, do you think it may be a cemetery?
They stopped and shivered in spite of the heat.
It was indeed a cemetery. Strange that it had taken them so long. This place of inviolate shade standing among cultivated fields could have been nothing else. Not that they could yet see crosses or graves. They were still at the bottom of the dip, picking their way over the soggy patches. Innocenti was a clumsier jumper than Clara, and one of his shoes sank into the mud, but she did not want to offend him by offering a hand. Now they were ascending the unexpectedly steep bank. The boundaries of the graveyard were marked by no wall, no fence posts, no ditch, no embankment, only by the unbroken row of close-planted ancient birches. The soil of the field merged with a magnificent, luxurious sward, free from weeds and not overgrown, though it was neither trampled nor mown. Just the sort of grass you would wish to find in a graveyard.
How shady and quiet it was.
The purest and kindest refuge in that carefully landscaped locality. Some of the graves were fenced. Others were simply nameless, grass-grown hillocks. There were even quite recent ones. Innocenti was surprised how much room there still was. There are 100 graves here at most, and there's easily room for 50 more. You probably don't need to ask anyone, you just come along and dig. Where my mother is buried in Moscow, there was all the bother of getting a permit from the Moscow Soviet, then greasing the cemetery superintendent's palm, and there isn't room to put your foot between graves, and to cap it all, they dig up old graves to make room for new ones. Those old birches must have saved the spacious graveyard from tractors. Their raincoats seemed to throw themselves on the ground, and they sat down without thinking, looking out over the rolling landscape. Now that they had left the sunlight for the shade, they had a clear view all around. The crossing keeper's hut at the stop was a distant white shape. Smoke crept over the tops of the trees lining the track. They looked, breathed deeply, and were silent. It was comfortable sitting there. Ink rested his head on his raised knees and was still. Clara could see the back of his neck. It was scrawny, like that of a little boy, but it had received the unhurried attention of a skillful hairdresser.
"Such a tidy graveyard," Clara marvelled. "No cattle dung, no spilled tractor fuel."
Innocenti sighed happily.
"Yes, this is the place to be buried. I won't be so lucky. They'll shove me onto a plane in a lead coffin, then rush me off in a truck somewhere."
"It's a bit early to be thinking about that, Ink."
"When everything is a lie, Clara dear, you get tired early. Very early. Twice as quickly."
His voice sounded weak and weary. Was he thinking of his work? Of life in general? Or just of his wife? Clara could not ask him to explain.
"What was in the cabinet, then?"
"In the cabinet?"
Innocenti, always tense and preoccupied, frowned in concentration.
"I'll tell you what was in the cabinet."
But the very thought of explaining in detail seemed to tire him.
"No, it's a long story. Some other time, perhaps."
If it was too long a story then, when wouldn't it be? Perhaps he was temperamentally capable of taking an interest only in what was new to him. If so, how could she ever catch up with his thoughts?
"You have no relatives left, then?"
"Just imagine. I have an uncle, my mother's brother. But I knew nothing about him either until last year."
"You've never met him?"
"Just once, when I was little. But I had no memory of him at all."
"Where does he live?"
"In Tver."
"Where?"
"In Kalinin, then. It's only 2 hours by train, but I can never get around to visiting him. Anyway, how could I when I'm never in Russia? I wrote to him, and the old man was overjoyed."
"Listen, Ink, you must go and see him. You'll be sorry later if you don't."
"I intend to. I really do. I'll go someday soon. I promise."
Out of the punishing sun, Innocenti had recovered and was looking more cheerful.
Where to now?
It was a long way to the forest in any direction, and there were no paths. There was a field of sunflowers to one side of the graveyard and a beet field on the other. They could only return to their old path and follow the women toward the village. There would be more forest somewhere. They drifted on. Innocenti had taken off his jacket. His shoulder blades stuck out sharply under his thin white shirt. He was wearing his hat again, for protection from the sun. Clara was amused.
Know what you look like? Yesenin, coming home from Europe to his native village.
Innocenti grinned and made an effort to remember Yesenin's words.
My homeland. Away from you, what have I found? A stranger now to you and to myself, knowing no longer how to plough or how to sow.
They were entering a deserted street. The facing rows of houses were 10 meters apart, but the roadway was beyond repair, rutted and churned up by tractors and heavy trucks. There were knee-high ridges of baked mud in places, and in others pools of leaden sludge which no summer would ever be long enough to dry out. Communication between the two sides of the street would have been no more difficult if a river had flowed between them. There was firm footing only immediately in front of the houses, and once you had chosen one side of the street, you had to stick to it. On their side, a girl with a wicker basket walked quickly toward them.
"Little girl," Innocenti began, but quickly realized that she was older than he had thought. "The young lady."
But by now she was almost upon him, and it turned out that she was a woman of nearly 40, remarkably small, and with cataracts on both eyes. Afraid that she might suspect him of sarcasm, Innocenti no longer knew what to call her.
"What's the name of this village?" he asked.
"Rozhdestvo."
Her clouded eyes barely glanced at them, and she walked quickly on. The two young people exchanged a look of surprise.
"Rozhdestvo? What an unusual name."
"Why Rozhdestvo?"
they called after her.
"How should I know? It's just what they called it,"
she answered over her shoulder, and went on.
Where had all those bustling women from the train trickled away to?
There was no sign of life on the street or in the yards. Neither the ill-fitting matchwood doors, which seemed to belong to chicken coops rather than houses, nor the unopenable double windows without ventilation panes, looked as though human life could be concealed behind them. The traditional pigs and poultry were nowhere to be seen or heard. Only the wretched rags and blankets hung out on clotheslines in one of the yards showed that someone had been there that morning. Hot sunlight flooded the silent air. They caught sight of someone moving deep inside one of the yards. A stout old woman in galoshes was shuffling between puddles, examining something she held in her hand. They called to her, but she did not hear. They called again. She looked up.
"I'm hard of hearing,"
she informed them in a cracked, toneless voice. Her eyes showed no surprise at these sharply dressed passers-by.
"Could we buy some milk from you?"
Clara asked. They didn't want milk, but she knew from her visits to collective farms that this was the best way to strike up a conversation.
"No cows,"
the old woman answered gravely. A yellow-white chick lay still in her hand, not struggling or twitching.
"Tell me, what was that church called?"
Innocenti asked.
"What do you mean, was called?"
She looked at him as though through a mist. There was a solemn self-assurance in her jowly face.
"Every church has a name, doesn't it?"
"That's about all it's got," she said. "They shut it down I don't know how long ago. In the 20s. It's an hour by bus to the nearest church. There used to be a summer church near here, but the prisoners pulled it down."
"What prisoners?"
"The Germans."
"Why?"
"They sent the bricks to Nara. Look, my chicks keep dying. This is the fourth. What do you think that is?"
Clara and Innocenti shrugged sympathetically.
"Maybe she's crushing them,"
the old woman said thoughtfully, shuffling toward the low door of her cottage. After that, they saw nothing at all moving, not a soul right to the end of the street. No dog showed itself or barked. There was nothing but two or three hens quietly grubbing away. Then a cat slunk out of the thistles, stalking something, no longer a domestic animal. It did not turn its head to look at the two human beings, but sniffed the ground all around and went on. toward the no less dead Main Street, on which this one abutted. Where the two streets broadened and intersected, they came upon the church, a squat, solid building of ornamental brickwork with inset brick crosses and looming over it, a bell tower with rows of apertures at two levels. Moss and weeds grew there, and many swallows and still smaller birds hovered noiselessly around the tower, restlessly darting into the slits and out again. The dome of the bell tower was inaccessible and undamaged, but the metal sheeting had been stripped from the roof of the church, and only its bare ribs remained. Both roof crosses had survived for two decades and still stood in their places. The door at the base of the bell tower was wide open, a paraffin lamp was burning in the darkness inside, and milk cans stood there, but there was no one to be seen. The door to the crypt of the church was also open, and sacks stood on the steps, but again there was no one around. There must once have been a fence around the church and a paved yard, but no trace of them remained. Heavy trucks and tractors had criss-crossed the ground on both sides of the church and between the church and the bell tower, leaving deep ruts in their convulsive eagerness to struggle through the mud without getting bogged down, reach the storehouse and escape, perhaps for the last time. The sick, mutilated earth was covered with incrustations of mud like hideous grey scabs and putrescent puddles of leaden sludge. There was the church. But the two young people took a long time finding a dry path across the street to it. They had to walk away to one side, then follow a tortuous route, jumping from spot to spot. Broken, mud-caked slabs of marble littered the road, and there were smaller pieces and chips of clean marble, white, pink, and yellow, by the walls of the church. Innocenti was feeling the heat, but was not flushed. If anything, the sun had made him paler. The wisps of hair straying from under his hat were wet with sweat. They went closer to the church. There was a foul smell in the hot, still air. From stagnant water, dead cattle, or an open sewer somewhere. They began to regret coming, and had no wish to inspect the church, even if there had been anything to see. Beyond the church, the ground sloped down to a host of huge, rounded willows, a whole kingdom of willows, and their only way of escape lay through that wall of green. But someone was calling out to them.
"Wouldn't have a smoke, would you, citizens?"
A diminutive peasant, with shoulders hunched up to his ears, as though he were permanently cold or frightened, but he looked crafty too, had appeared from somewhere and was looking them over. Innocenti looked apologetic, but slapped a pocket as though he hoped against hope to find a pack.
"I don't smoke, comrade."
"Too bad."
In spite of this disappointment, the necklace one did not go away, but continued examining these exotic newcomers with his restless eyes. Although he couldn't see the car they must have come in, he obviously took them for a novel variety of the boss species.
"What was that church called?"
"Church of the Nativity," he said, no longer respectfully.
He had made up his mind about them as soon as they spoke, and he vanished as suddenly as he had appeared. But a little farther down the slope, they noticed another man, this one with an uncovered wooden leg. He was wearing a blue cotton shirt with white calico patches, and resting on a stone under a lime tree.
"Where did all the marble come from?" Innocenti asked him.
"Eh?"
was the patchwork peasant's reply.
"All those coloured stones there."
"Oh, that.
They smashed the altar."
He thought a bit.
"The iconostasis, I mean."
"What for?"
He thought again.
"To make the road."
"What's that smell around here?"
Clara asked.
"Eh?"
The one-legged man was surprised. He thought a bit.
"Ah. Must be from the cattle yard. Our cattle yard's just over there."
He pointed, but they did not look. They were in a hurry to get away to the willow trees down below.
"What's down there?"
they asked.
"Down there? Nothing."
He thought.
"Just a brook."
A path had been beaten down the slope. Clara felt like running downhill, but she looked anxiously at Innocenti's pale face and walked slowly at his side.
"A village like that really makes the graveyard attractive," she said, looking back. "Are you limping?"
"My shoe's chafing."
They stopped in the spreading shade of the first huge willow and looked around. Away from the stench, all was moist and green and fresh, and they could see the church up on the hill, but not the dreadfully mutilated earth around it. only the dots that were birds darting and sailing around the belfry. The view was a pleasant one.
"You look very tired," Clara said anxiously. "You must have a rest, and take a look at your foot."
Throwing the coats down, he sat on the ground, leaning against a sloping trunk. He closed his eyes, then lay back and gazed uphill at the church.
"You see, Clara dear, there are two nativities."
"What do you mean, two?"
"Ours and the Western Christmas. Ours you've just seen. The Western Christmas is a sky lit up by neon signs, streets jammed with cars, people suffocating in shops, presents from everybody to everybody else. And in some wretched, dirty shop window, a crib and Joseph on a donkey."
"What do you mean, Joseph on a donkey?"
Before he could answer, they caught sight of something they had failed to notice before. A grave with an obelisk stood on the edge of the steep bank by the church, where a row of limes had somehow survived.
"A pity we missed that.
I'll run over and take a look."
Clara darted across the hillside, ignoring the path. She ran as though she were enjoying it, but she didn't feel at all happy. She stood for a while, reading the inscription, then came back just as nimbly, sure-footedly avoiding the potholes.
"Right, then. Whose do you think it is?"
"Some priests?"
"It says, Eternal glory to the warriors of the 4th Division of the People's Militia, who died the death of the brave for the honour and independence, etc., from the Ministry of Finance."
"Ministry of Finance?"
His prominent ears twitched in surprise.
"Would you believe it? Those poor clerks.
How many of them fell here? I wonder. And how many men were there to a rifle?
4th Militia Division, you say?"
"Yes."
"A division without weapons. And the 4th such... What an absurd war it was. People's militia."
"Why absurd?"
Clara was puzzled. Innocenti just sighed and looked downcast.
"Don't you feel well? Maybe we'd better be getting back, Ink. Let's not go any farther."
He sighed again.
"No, it's all right. Hot weather doesn't suit me. And I've got the wrong shoes on. I wasn't thinking.
I wish I'd chosen a more comfortable pair myself. Where does it hurt?"
"Let's put some newspaper under your heel, then it won't rub so much."
That did the trick. Meanwhile, scudding clouds had appeared in the sky. From time to time the sun was hidden and it felt cooler.
"What do you say, Ink? Shall we move on or not? We should have gone into the forest, shouldn't we? If you like, we can walk along the river. It'll be shady down there, too."
He was feeling better.
"What a weakling I am," he said. "Comes of spending my life in cars. You're a heroine. Come on. Which bank do you prefer?"
Downstream there was a plank bridge. Cables attached to it were secured to the trunks of willows on either bank so that floods could not carry it away. To cross or not to cross? Different banks, different paths, different conversation, a different outing. They crossed. There was another symmetrically aligned plantation on the gently rising ground beyond the stream. The thirsty willows had chosen the water's edge, but behind them were rows and rows of birches and firs. There was a pond, too, with frogs and covered with fallen leaves. Its regular shape showed that it was man-made. Was this perhaps the derelict estate of some gentleman? There was no one to ask. Seen from between the spreading willows, the church looked still more beautiful, high on the hill. This was the way that worshippers from another nearby village would take, summoned by the bells. But they had seen enough of villages and went on along the bank. It was very pleasant walking in this moist, shady, secluded world, where the stream gurgled and rippled in the shallows, while in deeper places the surface was still, except for occasional mysterious tremors, and everywhere dragonflies skimmed the water. There must surely be fish and crayfish. It would have been good to bare their legs up to their knees and wade like boys looking for crayfish, but there were impassable nettle beds and thickets of young aspens in their way. A stout, weirdly twisted willow growing on their bank leaned out to span the stream, and its twisted branches were like the handrails of a bridge. Clara clapped her hands.
"A baobab! What a beauty! Let's go across it!"
It looks like better footing on the other bank.
Innocenti shook his head doubtfully, but Clara had already jumped boldly onto the slanting trunk. She extended a firm hand to him.
Come on.
She felt sure that they were doing the right thing. Surely on the other bank something would happen, something would be said that would give meaning to this whole excursion. Innocenti hesitantly held out his soft hand. The willow slanted gradually but rose high. Innocenti followed, taking short steps and apparently trying not to look down. But then a branch he took hold of barred his way and he had to clamber over it. He did all this with a look of concentration and in complete silence. They landed without a scratch, but Ink had obviously not enjoyed the crossing. Things were no better on this side. They had nothing much to say to each other. They heard the clatter of a tractor somewhere higher up. Very soon it became impossible to walk close to the water. They had to leave the shade and make for higher ground by the only possible path. Innocenti's limp was more and more pronounced. They came out on a spacious yard with a single small building and a single open shed. The small building was probably an office, a pale pink flag with a ragged edge stirred feebly above it. The shed was just wide enough to accommodate in a single line the slogan, "Forward to the victory of communism," exhorting a multitude of rusty red, blistery blue, and scabby green machines of unknown function, water wagons, a field kitchen, trailers with shafts erect, trailers with shafts earthward, all haphazardly abandoned over an expanse of land so scarred and rutted that it was almost impassable, even on foot. There was no one in sight except a man in grubby overalls, wandering from one machine to another, bending down to look at something and straightening up again. A single tractor was at work on a hillside. There was no other path. Picking their way among the potholes as best they could, they crossed the yard. Innocenti was limping. It was hot again. They went back down to the stream. At that point it flowed under a concrete bridge. A solid, prosaic bridge, leaving nothing to choose between the two banks, the two destinies. They seemed to have arrived at a highway. "Shall we try to get a ride?" Innocenti said. "We don't want to go back to the station again." The day was only half over, but their outing was at an end. Why was there always this hermetic screen between people? They could so nearly see, so nearly hear how to help each other. But it was not to be. It could not be. They found a little spring under the bridge, sat down, drank from it, and were about to wash their feet when they heard a heavy rumbling up above. They went out and looked up at the road from the bottom of the embankment. A file of identical new-looking trucks, with new-looking tarpaulin covers, was rolling along the road. The end of the column was out of sight over the hill, and its head had reached the top of another hill. There were trucks with aerials, breakdown trucks, trucks with barrels marked inflammable, and trucks with field kitchen trailers. They carefully kept their distance, driving at intervals of precisely 20 meters, and the concrete bridge was not silent for a moment. In every cab an officer or sergeant sat beside an army driver. Soldiers, lots of them, huddled under tarpaulin covers. Their faces could be seen through the window flaps and from the rear of each vehicle, looking indifferent, it seemed, to the place they had left, to the scene speeding past them, and to the place to which they were being driven, in suspended animation for the term of their service. From the time they left their shelter, Clara and Innocenti counted 100 trucks before the noise died away. They walked back to where water gurgled around the sawed-off piles of a previous wooden bridge. Innocenti lowered himself onto a stone and said helplessly, "My life is in ruins."
"But why, Ink? Why is it in ruins?" Clara burst out in despair. "You keep promising to explain, but you don't tell me anything."
He looked at her with suffering eyes, holding a broken stick like a pencil. He drew a circle on the damp ground. "You see this circle? That's our country. That's the first circle. Now, here's the second. A circle with a larger diameter. That is mankind at large. You would think that the first forms part of the second, wouldn't you?"
"Not in the least."
"There are barriers of prejudice. Not to mention barbed wire and machine guns.
To break through, physically or spiritually, is well-nigh impossible. Which means that mankind, as such, does not exist. There are only fatherlands, everyone's fatherland alien to everyone else's. It was about then that the special section sent Clara some forms to fill in. She had no difficulty with them. Her origins were impeccable. Her life story was not long in the telling. It was lit by the even glow of prosperity. It was free from acts that might compromise a Soviet citizen. The forms were in circulation for some months, and they gave complete satisfaction. In the meantime, Clara had graduated from the Institute and passed through the guarded gates of the mysterious Marfino complex.